All right. I'm coming from you not from a perspective of a psychologist or a biologist or a neurologist or any of those gists. I'm coming today from a perspective of a woman who spent 30 years working with kids in juvenile corrections. So I got a chance to see them all. So I'm here today on their behalf to share with you kind of what has happened to them, some of them, and to some other kids as well. Just to kind of put it on your mind, bring the discussions. I don't have the answers about what to do with them all, but to tell you what's happening with them. And I'm sure, how many of you are teachers, nurses, doctors? Oh, everybody, we got a little bit of everybody in here. Great. Well, let's talk about these kids. And see, when I was working, I didn't have all this highfangled technology either, so I want to begin talking a little bit about violence. And I'm not going to try to define it. I'm not here to define it. You know what it is. You know it when you see it. But I do want to talk a little bit about where it occurs and what happens to the kids. First of all, the community is one place where it happens, whether it's the Denver, downtown Denver, downtown wherever you are, rural areas, wherever. But the community is supposed to be a place of protection and solidarity for our kids. In many instances, it becomes what? A site of violence for our kids, including peer violence, violence related to guns and weapons, gangs, police violence, physical and sexual violence, and violence associated with the mass media. How many times have you heard little kids today cry because they think a tsunami or they think that some terrible natural disaster is going to come and get them, and because they see it on television over and over and over again? And most recently, there are documented cases of cyberbullying through the internet or mobile phones. Now, I saw something last night that there's a new phone that you can do all kinds of connections, up to 8 connections. And I thought, why would you want to have 8 internet connections that you can visually speak to at the same time? But it's there. And you know there'll be some terrible issues that will result as a result of this as well. But communities aren't all violent. But many of them are, and we can't ignore it. And that's why people look for gated communities. They look for like communities, whether it's because one that looks like them or one that acts like them or whatever. Then there are the schools. Schools have an important role in protecting our children. Educational settings also expose children to violence and may even contribute to the violence via some of the practices. Like, how many of your schools still use corporal punishment? Any of them? Some schools still do, I'm told. And then how many of them use humiliating forms of psychological punishment where they treat sexual and gender-based violence and bullying in a significant way? I think we have to be just real careful of all the regular things that really contribute to this. Then, and I put wars on there because that's another thing that kids are becoming much more informed about or uninformed, misformed about, wars, because they see all the pictures of what's going on, around the world. However, the family still has the greatest potential to protect our children and provide for their physical and emotional safety. When I spent those years at the juvenile correctional facility, I remember the time when I went in there, there was a 76-bed facility that had 250 kids in there. And the public said, well, that's what they deserve. They're riding kids, they've committed a crime. That attitude is still pervasive. Now, we did change all that, but that's the kind of attitude that you get from the community and from some of the institutions that are supposed to be protecting the kids. In recent years, violence against children by parents and other family members has been documented over and over again. This can include physical, sexual, psychological, as well as just deliberate neglect of the kids. You see it over and over again. Frequently, children are exposed to physical violence without people really understanding that they're doing it, I think, sometimes. They have to stop and think about what they're doing. 27% of all violence occurs in the home. Most children that are murdered by someone they know. And domestic violence and physical abuse impacts millions of children every year all over the country. This just disturbs me. I cry every time I read the paper in the mornings because I read about some story, being a grandmother and a great-grandmother, it just hurts me that we still can't keep our kids safe, that they're still being, you know, being damaged in some way. Much of this violence is hidden behind closed doors, and that's the other really sad and tough thing about it. It's not out there where everybody can see it all the time. As a health professional, we have to fight, and I think we should fight, all of us as professionals, to establish a commitment to providing better protective custody of our kids in our care, and the ones that are not in our care that we see on the streets. When I see kids on the streets here in Denver at night, and they're by themselves, and they're little kids, I say to them, why aren't you at home? Why don't you go home? But we're afraid to say anything to kids anymore. We won't even talk to them. And I think we have to be able to step in and say something, because that's what adults do. They take care of children, whether they're our children or not. Children who live with domestic violence not only endure the distress of being surrounded by violence, but are also more likely to become victims of violence themselves, or to become perpetrators of violence. And I saw that so much in the juvenile system. As children grow and develop, if exposed to continued bouts of violence, either as a witness to it or as a victim, they face a range of possible effects, including trouble at school, trouble with their schoolwork, limited social skills, depression, anxiety, and other psychological problems. They also become a great risk for substance abuse and teenage pregnancy. When you think about it, that is certainly something that I'm sure have looked at over the time. Those 30 years that I spent in juvenile correction providing support and sometimes consequences for these transgressions really opened my eyes. Because of the large number of children exposed to domestic violence, it is important for child welfare professionals, supervisors, administrators, advocates, teachers, the courts, and everyone to really understand the impact of exposure to violence on these often silent victims. We have to be attentive to their at-risk situations. And we need to use protective measures to alleviate their continued victimization and not make them silent victims, but make them the primary victim so that they get the kind of intervention that they need early on. This leads me to suggest that we might want to look at something that's a concept that I ran across a few years ago, trauma-informed practice. How many of you are familiar with that concept? Okay. I don't know if you buy it. I don't know if you think it's the best thing to do. It's one thing that can be done. It's another thing that can be done. But we should be providing care to these children that is grounded in and directed by a thorough understanding of the neurological, the biological, the psychological, sociological effects of trauma and violence on humans, and be informed by the prevalence of these experiences in the people that we work with, so that we can provide the right kind of support for them, and we can customize the support to their particular needs. Now, another thing that disturbed me when I went to the literature to look at the numbers, it just, again, made me so sad. And the other thing that was so significant to me, having been away for 4 or 5 years, that child neglect is the most prevalent form of maltreatment, according to the National Child Abuse and Neglect Data System. Of 899,000 children who were victims in this particular time, 62.8% suffered from neglect alone, which was 564,765 children. 42.2% of child maltreatment were fatalities alone, and then 24.1% as a result of physical abuse and neglect, and then 27.3% as a result of multiple maltreatment types. To me, this is just so sad. In this time and age that we still have this kind of statistics as we talk about dealing with our kids. In 2005, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services data reported that of the 899 children, this is another way of looking at this, I just gave you that one, didn't I? 62.8% experienced neglect, while 9.3% were sexually abused, 16.6% were physically abused, 7.1% endured emotional and psychological abuse, and 14.3% experienced some other form of maltreatment, whether it's abandonment, threats, drug addiction, congenital drug addiction. How many of you know when we started having all the little babies born with adverse reactions to drugs? And then I found this study Eisenberg, I'm probably not pronouncing it right, that show that African-American adolescents are at a higher risk of exposure to community violence than other racial and ethnic groups. And that saddened me certainly even further. It saddened me to see any kid, but it certainly saddened me to see that we have not made many strides in that whole area for kids of color. There are other sources of stress that contribute to these kids having a terrible time as they grow up. Poverty, discrimination, frequent moves. How many times have you seen kids that have moved 8 or 9 times in 1 year? I've had school problems and people can't wonder why they're having problems. Well, I think if you think about the things that they're exposed to on a daily basis, it's understandable that they're having problems. And think about the refugee immigration experiences that some of the kids have in most of our cities. And this being separated from their families and from their siblings, and then the traumatic grief and loss that many of them suffer from having lost someone to a violent act, whether it's a gang fight or whether it's some other act where they've lost a loved one. These are a little calmer things to look at, but these are also things that I think contribute the kids that I work with. To me, when I would work with a group of kids, I wouldn't see sometimes 5% of the kids who had not had someone who'd been incarcerated within their family, whether it was their mother, their father, a real distant relative. But incarceration of parents is certainly still a real serious issue. And then children living in foster care, children with high risk of witnessing violent acts, children that live in areas where they don't have a parent there, or they have one parent gone, one parent in jail, or have other parents around them in jail, other family members around them in jail, end up having high risk for being seeing or being involved in a violent act. Violent crime is a reality for many children and adolescents nowadays. It's a reality for them. I mean, if you ask kids how many of them have been exposed, how many of them have actually had, I think you'll find that the majority of them will tell you that they've had some experience with it. Poverty and homelessness. The largest growing population in our area has been families who are homeless. Now think about what that creates for a child, what that creates for the children. And most of the facilities aren't set to handle families. I mean, think about what that must do to a child. And then you still have the runaways, which we've had, it's been a constant thing forever. And then I think a combination of all of this, sometimes you'll find some of all this in one family. And that's the even sadder tale. So what does this mean for us? What happens to these kids? What happens to these kids that have these things? Exposure to violence is a significant issue for these families. And I think, in my opinion, all socioeconomic groups are exposed to community violence, whether it's hidden in a high-income household or whatever. But so I think it's there. Having worked primarily with the gang project in Denver and having been exposed to many other cities and living in this area and other areas, kids are witnessing shootings, beatings, and are still becoming victims of crime. In fact, children living in urban neighborhoods have been exposed to the use of weapons, including guns, prior to ending high school. Probably over, I hate to give a percentage here, but a huge majority of them. Community violence that exposes kids to acts of interpersonal violence committed by individuals who are not intimately related to the victim is seen all over the country. These are the children and adolescents who walk to school afraid, who can't go out after dark, and who need our help. The children and adolescents either witness or become victims of community violence, I believe, are at high risk for post-traumatic stress disorder. Like I said, I'm not a psychologist, but looking at my review of literature, there's a lot of evidence, evidentiary studies that really show that there is some proof that this is happening. Anxiety disorders, injury development disorders, and juvenile crimes, which means there's an increase in crimes, and particularly for girls. For some reason, the fastest growing juvenile inmate is a female. Some children also exhibit aggressive behavior when exposed to community violence and view violence as the only way to deal with a dispute. That's why the schools have such trouble dealing with kids in schools, because kids resort to violence before mediation. According to the National Center for the Health Statistics in 2001, this is really sad, homicide was reported as the fourth leading cause of death for children aged 1 to 4, and youth aged 5 to 14, and the second leading cause of death for adolescents and young adults between 15 and 24. What does that say? What does that say about us and about this country? Many children who live in the inner cities and many large cities across the country witness community violence, whether we want to accept it or believe it or not, including shootings and beatings on a regular basis. Now, findings from a study by Howard Stanton and others revealed in 1988 that children who had witnessed or were victims of violence did have symptoms of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And that their findings show that it was similar to that of soldiers who had returned from the war. In that particular study, there were 349 African-American children in that study. They were 9 to 15 years of age, and they were all from low-income families. In another study by Gorman, Smith, and Tolan in 1998, it also showed that they demonstrated symptoms of depression, anxiety, and aggressive behaviors, and nonverbal aggressive acts against other children. Bullying, for example, was reported in a number of these kids and these families. There are tons of studies out there that have described the negative impact on these children. There has been a proven correlation between school violence and level of exposure to violence that these children have lived with. Too little time and attention is given to the effects of violence on children's development as a result of exposure to violence. That's my opinion. However, as I reviewed the literature for this presentation, it appears that researchers and professionals are now in some agreement that children can be adversely affected when they witness violence. Children should be viewed as primary victims rather than silent victims. Schools across the country are concerned about the low graduation rates, poor educational performances, and school violences. Churches, communities, families, and practitioners are concerned about stopping the violence that takes these lives. What can you do to help? What can we all do to help? We've got to do something to save these kids. Thank you.